This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that companies don't spend money on politics without expecting a little something back. Wall Street and its political outlays today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 26th of October is what my calendar says. Good, as always, to have you here, everybody. So much money, so little time. 13 days until Election Day. Tens, maybe even hundreds of millions of dollars to be spent between now and then on ads and getting out the vote and down-ballot races. Lots and lots of spending. There is a report out today detailing where Wall Street has been spending its money since this election season started heating up. $1.4 billion in all since the start of 2015. A combination of lobbying and federal campaign donations. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace gets us going with where that money's going.
The fact that Wall Street has been a kind of boogeyman during parts of this campaign hasn't stopped Wall Street firms and their employees from spending an average of $2.3 million a day on national politics. Jim Lardner is a spokesman for Americans for Financial Reform, a group that bills itself as an advocate for Wall Street accountability and which published this report. He says the industry's campaign spending has only gone up since the big financial reform bill, Dodd-Frank.
The financial industry has been fighting ever since to get those reforms pared back, rolled back, weakened.
Within the sector, hedge funds were the biggest spenders on campaign contributions, and interest groups like the National Association of Realtors led the spending on lobbyists. Are they getting their money's worth?
Quite often, success will mean stopping something from happening.
Diana Dwyer is a political science professor at the California State University, Chico. She says there are two kinds of donors, ideological donors who support a candidate they like, and those who seek access, who want to be at the table to do things like prevent new regulations from passing or soften existing ones like Dodd-Frank. Those donors tend to spread their money around and give to both parties. As to whether they're buying influence.
Well, I'm sure they hope they are. That's probably the goal.
Political science professor Kay Schlossman at Boston University says there's also a broader context for these great big numbers.
There has been tremendous growth in incomes at the very top.
In other words, these donors from Wall Street also just have more money to give. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
A couple other things before we move on out of a couple of trendy companies in this economy. Item number one, Tesla. I'm going to steal a line from a Felix Salmon tweet that I just saw before I came into the studio. Today, in unexpected headlines, Elon Musk's electric car company reported a quarterly profit today, contra virtually all expectations. Seems the Model X, the one with the fancy gull wing doors, is selling quite nicely. Thank you very much. Item number two, Snapchat. Bloomberg reported this afternoon that the now you see it, now you don't messaging company is looking to raise $4 billion when it goes public next year. That is a $25 to $35 billion valuation. I'm going to say that again, $25 to $35 billion for Snapchat. On Wall Street today, traders seem to touch dyspeptic. Actually, two indices down, one up, lots of bouncing around during the session. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Welcome. My name is Immigration Services Officer Meyer.
There's a place that Lazaro Carrion had been avoiding his whole life.
The Department of Homeland Security is one of those, like, you don't want to see it, you don't want to acknowledge it, you know, it's kind of like el cucuy, you know, it's taboo, don't even bring it up.
Till just a couple of weeks ago.
Please remember that you will not be a U.S. citizen unless and until you repeat the Oath of Allegiance during today's ceremony.
When he walked into the Homeland Security field office just outside Seattle to finally become a U.S. citizen, he was just shy of his 32nd birthday.
You had a lot of frustration and fear going through buildings like this, and now that I don't have to, I have to replace him with some new feelings of, like, you know, gratitude.
Thank you. You may be seated.
For a lot of immigrants in this country, the American dream starts years before they ever officially become Americans. For a lot of them, from Mexico in particular, that dream starts in the fields. Agriculture has always been an entry point for immigrants in this country, the first rung on that economic ladder. We started our two-part series on immigration and this election yesterday with farmers and workers in Washington State who've been dealing with a labor shortage for years now.
The American grower shouldn't be saddled with not being able to get enough people.
Today we cross the Cascade Mountains to Seattle to check out the second largest industry for immigrants in Washington.
We're strange bedfellows with the agricultural industry in the state.
Michael Schutzler is the CEO of a trade association that represents this state's 9,000 tech companies.
When I speak to my counterparts in the agricultural side, we see the world the same way. The immigrant workforce creates opportunity sets for the domestic workforce. It doesn't take it away. It actually creates it.
Our series with Frontline and PBS NewsHour is called How the Deck is Stacked. Tech, agriculture, and immigration all come together at a desk in an airy open office overlooking Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle. It's a desk that is all decked out in red, white, and blue.
I was pleasantly surprised when I came to the office the next day after my ceremony. My coworkers had decorated my desk with some flags.
Lazaro Carrion works for a startup called Remitly. He's a marketing manager there. But before he was that, he was called something else, undocumented.
I'm just happy that they recognize that this is a big deal.
You are Mexican-American?
Correct.
How long have you been in this country?
About 20 years.
So you came as a kid?
Yes, 7 years old.
Tell me that story.
So I originally wanted to come to this country because I thought ice cream fell from the sky. I didn't speak any English, so my family comes from the U.S. to Mexico and visit this, and my cousins tell me, hey, nieve cae en los Estados Unidos. Nieve is the Spanish word for ice cream, so I'm thinking vanilla, chocolate. You know? So as a kid, your imagination just takes over. So I cry to my parents, and they let me come with my aunt on vacation. And soon enough, a vacation turned into a longer stay. My parents then came over, and we knew the education here was better. My sisters and I, we took our education seriously, and so that was a priority for my family, so we decided to stay.
Lazaro's parents pushed him to do well in school, and he did. So well, in fact, that he got a full scholarship to a liberal arts college in Walla Walla, Washington.
I used to be the barber on campus. I used to cut hair. Instead of charging people a fixed rate, I started taking donations.
He graduated in 2007, but without papers, he couldn't get a job.
I had a BA, and I could not find the employment that I wanted, so I decided to take matters into my own hands.
He did what he was supposed to do, apply for a visa, but that meant after spending nearly his whole life in the United States, he had to move back to Mexico and get in line.
Are your parents still alive?
My parents are still alive.
When you went to them and said, listen, I'm going to go back to Mexico, what did they say?
They thought I wasn't being serious. I've played it safe most of my life. When it came down to making that decision, I told him I bought my one-way ticket. I don't know when I'm coming back, but I'll see you when I return.
You were there for a while.
I was there for 4 years. And it was a situation where I applied for my visa, got denied, actually got barred 10 years.
Say that again. You got barred from the United States for 10 years.
For 10 years, correct.
Because?
Because I was previously in this country as an undocumented immigrant.
His wait was cut short a little bit when he married his girlfriend, an American citizen, back in 2012. And when he did finally become a citizen himself a couple of weeks ago, he breathed a 20-year sigh of relief.
Definitely a good day. Definitely emotional and a little bittersweet. I was not able to have my entire family present.
To know how far he's come, it helps to know where Lazaro started. Back on the other side of the Cascades, where we were yesterday, in Yakima, picking apples.
I hated it.
I was out in an orchard yesterday. Wait. Holding those apple baskets, man, around you. Those, I mean, they weighed a ton. It's hard work.
I
I have never purchased an apple. I'll put it that way.
Seriously.
I don't ever want to work there again.
His parents, though, are still there.
My mother is a sorter. She sorts. And my dad, he's a stacker, so that once the apples get put into the box, they make sure that they get shipped and sent out of the warehouse.
The company that Lazaro works for is called Remitly. It's a business built, interestingly enough, for immigrants.
The majority of our customer base are, you know, people who have moved thousands of miles away from their families to seek higher earning power, to seek a better life.
Matt Oppenheimer is one of the co-founders. The company has an app that lets people working here send money to their families abroad. But it's not just a business built for immigrants. It's also a business built in large part by immigrants.
I'm Shivas, one of the co-founders at Remitly.
Shivas Gulati came to the United States on a student visa.
I initially came here to finish my undergrad, went on to get my master's.
He met Matt. The two started developing Remitly. And right when they got going, Shivas went back to India to get married and sort out his visa. And then he got stuck there.
And that kind of led us into this whole immigration rat hole of how do you get someone on an immigration visa to, you know, be a co-founder and kind of start a business.
How long was your delay?
I ended up spending about 5 months in India.
Trying to run a startup here.
Yep.
How did that work?
It's thanks to Skype and you know, all the chat software we have.
Matt knew he had to do something.
He was a crucial part of the company. It's only me and him.
So he got on a plane, he flew 22 hours to Delhi, and he showed up at the American Embassy to prove that their company was legit.
Maybe the entrepreneur in me, I didn't want to give up.
After months of hearing nothing, Shivas did finally get his visa.
What would have happened if Matt hadn't gotten on a plane and gone and camped out in front of the embassy in Delhi?
Hard to say. Worst case, I would still probably be back in Delhi.
You probably wouldn't be sitting here with 100 people working for you, would you?
Probably not.
75% of the startups in our industry, funded by venture capital, are founded by immigrants. So they're the ones creating jobs for Americans.
Michael Schutzler, the trade association guy, he ought to know. His dad, a German immigrant, helped start MapQuest.
So if we want to have a really viable, successful tech ecosystem, we need to allow those immigrants who want to start companies to do so.
Remitly's Matt Oppenheimer says that in order to scale up, his company has to rely on foreign workers.
You know, the fallacy that people are taking American jobs. I mean, I said are close to 100 people. We have lots of open roles right now. And we have a very high bar for the talent that we recruit.
Open jobs.
Open jobs, yeah. We have lots of open jobs. We are all about hiring the best, engineers, the best product managers, the best folks out there. And I think that there's a shortage of talent like that in the United States. And so folks that, you know, are here that are on H-1Bs that help continue to grow our business, care about our customers, are perfect folks that we've been able to hire and build our team.
We have 36 countries represented here today, illustrating the astounding diversity of our new citizens.
At that Seattle Homeland Security field office, the one where Lazaro officially became an American citizen, dozens of people line up every day from all over the world.
Indonesia, Iran.
Originally, I'm from Hong Kong.
India.
I'm originally from Iraq.
Manzanillo, Colima, Mexico.
I was born in Kampala, Uganda.
United Kingdom, Vietnam.
Please raise your right hands and repeat after me.
Finally, you know, we find home and, you know, living the dream. So, you know, we want to just be a part of this great community.
It's been a journey for about 16 and a half years for us.
I'm excited. Yeah, we're really, really excited. I have been waiting it for quite a while. And finally, it's the day today.
Congratulations, you are America's newest citizen.
Emotionally, you're having like these flashbacks of when you were a kid and, you know, like all these times that you were reminded that, no, that's not for you. No, you can't join the military. No, you can't be president one day. No, you can't qualify for FAFSA. No. A lot of these no's. And now it's yes, 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 yes. All these yeses. And now what are you going to do with them? And so I really can't believe that this moment has already happened. I knew it would come, but it was just beautiful.
Politicians and analysts can argue all day about why the immigration system in this country isn't working. But when you go talk to people in the immigration economy, you learn what that dysfunction actually means. Part one of our story and of our whole series, it's called How the Deck is Stacked, lives online at marketplace.org. Pictures, videos, the whole smash. Also, a quick thing I did, answering some of your questions about the American immigration economy. Coming up.
I think people are interested in what they're eating and drinking now in a way that they haven't been in past decades.
Including beer. Only the good beer, though. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 30 points today at 10%, closed at 18,199. The NASDAQ down 33.6%, 5250. The S&P 500 off 3 points, about a 10%, 2139. Apple's iPhone sales numbers were not too healthy, yet another drop. Although the company reckons it's going to get a boost during the holiday season. Oh, don't they all? Either way, the market wasn't happy. Take a bite from its share price down 2.2%. Remember those back-to-back ads during the Olympics on NBC this summer? NBC owner Comcast made a bunch of money on them. Most successful games ever. Thank you. Profits up 15% that quarter. Not enough to stop worries about that looming AT&T Time Warner deal, though. What it's going to mean for Comcast, its shares fell about 3% or so today. Bond prices also fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.79%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A little bit of retail news now, all right? If I asked you which retailer is on track to become the biggest seller of clothing in this country, who would you go with? Macy's, maybe? TJ Maxx, possibly? Good guesses, both. Also wrong, both. An analyst report out today says that Amazon's clothing and accessory sales are expected to grow about 30% next year. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
25-year-old Emily De La Cruz buys a lot of her clothes on Amazon.
No. Not a lot. I buy my whole life on Amazon.
My bad. Her latest buy? Trendy rose gold sunglasses for $12.99.
Everyone's just like, where do you get these glasses from? Where are they from? What are they? And I'm like, guys, it's on Amazon.
Amazon has been quietly establishing itself in the fashion market. John Blackledge is an internet analyst with Cowen and Company, which just issued a report about Amazon. It says Amazon currently has about 6% of the apparel market. The company could almost triple that within the next few years.
So we'll comfortably pass Macy's. And remember, Macy's is closing 100 stores next year that generate about $1 billion in revenue.
Blackledge says Amazon has more than 150 brand partnerships, its own private labels, and a new interactive daily show online. Think QVC, but younger and hipper.
Tonight on Style Kids Live, think you can't wear over-the-knee boots with a dress?
Amazon has a foothold in this space because customers, especially Prime members, see it as convenient. Plus, there's free shipping, says Lauren Friedman, a digital strategist with Astound Commerce.
It has kind of a fast fashion component in a different way.
She says you can order and return as many clothes as you want. You can't pop into a dressing room to try them on, but that doesn't seem to be turning people off. Brick-and-mortar retailers are going to have to step up their game, says Frank Leo, a retail strategist at Kurt Salmon.
It seems like they continue to play a game of catch-up.
Kind of tough when tastes and technology are constantly changing the rules. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
You know all those jokes, not so much jokes, really, as sad realizations of reality about liberal arts majors not being able to get decent-paying jobs? Yeah, well, not so fast. A study from the National Association of Colleges and Employers says people with liberal arts degrees are getting jobs, and they're getting paid more for them than they were last year. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains what's going on.
The study looked at data from more than 400 schools that represent almost 500,000 graduates. Edwin Koch is director of research and public policy for the group. He says it was good news for many liberal arts majors' checkbooks.
English majors and language majors, area studies majors, all increased their salaries by 13% or more.
And he says people with liberal arts degrees typically don't have to worry as much as others during an economic downturn.
Their situation has actually been fairly stable over the years, whereas the career-oriented majors during a recession actually feel more of an impact than liberal arts majors.
So are these data a direct indictment of getting a STEM degree? That's science, technology, engineering, and math. Carl Van Horn says probably not. He teaches workforce development at Rutgers University. He says actually employers are looking less at what you studied in college and looking more at what you've done in the world.
Employers spend less money on entry-level training or other kinds of onboarding strategies than they used to. They want to know, can this person add value from day one?
Peter Bennett agrees. He's a partner at Bennett Gaynor Sustainable Staffing, an employment agency. He says, of course, what an employer wants varies from job to job, but
if it's more of a specialized kind of position, then they want someone to have some type of experience in what they're going to at least eventually be getting themselves involved in.
And he says those psychology and musical therapy degrees are still tough for him to place. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Yesterday on the program, as you heard a little bit ago, we were up at an apple orchard in the Yakima Valley in Washington State. An apple orchard where, as it happens, they also grow hops, as in beer hops, a crop that is in super high demand right now thanks to the craft beer boom. That's the backdrop for this next interview, a chat with Lucy Birmingham about her new book. It's called My Beer Year. Lucy, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me.
I envy you because you had the idea to spend a year writing about beer. I should have thought of that. Not a tough job.
Well, I wouldn't say that. You know.
Well, because it's a quest, right? I mean, this is actually a quest story, right? Your search and trial to become, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Cicerone?
Cicerone, you've got it.
Yes. Okay.
I think that's the American way to say it.
And that is basically a sommelier for beer.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Now, what are we drinking?
All right. I brought two Oregon beers. This first one we're going to try is a Freem Pilsner. These guys are located in Hood River, Oregon.
Okay.
The Freem.
So don't give it to me. You hold it and give me your Cicerone interpretation of this beer. What would you do? You're sniffing it now.
I'm sniffing it now. It smells a little bit like honey, a little grassy to me.
Is it like wine where you can identify the hop? And that's in it, and the like field where it's grown, and all that jazz. Right? I mean, you hear people do this with grapes, right?
Right, right. I think, yeah, you're sort of getting into that territory. I mean, beer's an agricultural product, right? It has some terroir. Hops grown in the Pacific Northwest are different than hops grown in New Zealand. So, yeah, there's that possibility for sure.
Why do you think, after having spent a year plus of your life on this book and on the Cicerone course, why did craft brewing explode in this country? What happened? Because, when I was a kid, it was Rheingold and Schlitz and Pabst and, all those fizzy yellow things. And you're like, man.
I think people are interested in what they're eating and drinking now in a way that they haven't been in past decades. There are lots of people who are doing home brewing now, and that's a great way to get into really understanding what is fermentation, how do temperatures affect beer, as it's fermenting, all those sort of technicalities that really make you appreciate what you're drinking in a glass.
Do you ever look around at craft brewing today, which has been and is booming, and say, you know what? We might be in a little bit of bubble territory here because it's getting a little too big too fast.
Well, I am not really sensing the bubble. And I think it's because I do sense this thirst for flavor and variety, and people are curious. They want to try new things. What is happening are the big mergers and acquisitions.
Right. And it just happened here in L.A. with Golden Road, a brewery that I've been to and I enjoy. And we had actually the founders on the show. They were bought by AB InBev. And all the craft brewing fans that I know are like, oh, my goodness, they've sold out to big corporate America. Is that going to change good craft beers?
Oh, this is the ongoing debate right now in the craft beer community. People are so worried. And I think one of the reasons why is transparency. You know, it's going to take a lot more work for people who enjoy craft beer and enjoy the idea of an independent brewery to really know where their beer is coming from. They might be enjoying that IPA, but if they knew that it was produced by one of the world's biggest corporate beer makers, it might have a little bit less intrigue for them, a little bit less something.
Right.
And it might taste exactly the same. Who knows? But I think people deserve to know who owns the brewery.
Are you hopeful about the future of craft beer in this country?
I am hopeful.
Yeah.
And it's because I'm constantly trying beers that are so innovative and so interesting. And I'm excited that so many people are interested in learning more. That's really what's changing is people want to know more about beer.
It's a book called My Beer Year by Lucy Birmingham. Lucy, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
There is more of Lucy schooling me on beer tasting and how we're all probably drinking out of the wrong glasses at home shaker pint glasses. I'm looking at you. It's at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that as we close in on 2 weeks to go until Election Day, it appears cable news has at long last learned its lesson after getting well and truly played the last time Donald Trump did an event at his new hotel in Washington, D.C. The cable networks pretty much stayed away from Mr. Trump's appearance at today's official opening ceremony. We, however, are going to mark the occasion the same way we did last time with this, what Mr. Trump said and what everybody else heard.
Opulence, luxury, gold. This is the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C.
Nice hotel. We have put in tremendous amounts of work and energy and money.
All of this luxury.
Under budget and ahead of schedule. Isn't that nice?
Terrific. Tremendous. Have you seen our $27 tater tots?
Welcome.
Bienvenue.
Namaste.
Bienvenido.
Ahlan wa sahlan.
I said this will be the best hotel in Washington. I think it may be one of the great hotels anywhere in the world. That's the way it turned out.
Grand opening today because brand is everything. All right, we're out of here. The Dow ended up 30 points today at 10%. The NASDAQ down 33.6%. The S&P 500 off 3 points. That is a 10% to the offside. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.